Chapter 5. The Peekaboo World. Toward the middle years of the 19th century, two ideas came together whose convergence provided 20th century America with a new metaphor of public discourse. Their partnership overwhelmed the age of exposition and laid the foundation for the age of show business. One of the ideas was quite new, the other as old as the cave paintings of Altamira. We shall come to the old idea presently. The new idea was that transportation and communication could be disengaged from each other, that space was not an inevitable constraint on the movement of information. Americans of the 1800s were very much concerned with the problem of conquering space. By the mid-19th century, the frontier extended to the Pacific Ocean, and a rudimentary railroad system begun in the 1830s had started to move people and merchandise across the continent. But until the 1840s, information could move only as fast as a human being could carry it. To be precise, only as fast as a train could travel, which, to be even more precise, meant about 35 miles per hour. In the face of such a limitation, the development of America as a national community was retarded. In the 1840s, America was still a composite of regions, each conversing in its own ways, addressing its own interests. A continent-wide conversation was not yet possible. The solution to these problems, as every schoolchild used to know, was electricity. To no one's surprise, it was an American who found a practical way to put electricity in the service of communication, and in doing so eliminated the problem of space once and for all. I refer, of course, to Samuel Finley Breese Morse, America's first true spaceman. His telegraph erased state lines, collapsed regions, and, by wrapping the continent in an information grid, created the possibility of a unified American discourse. But at a considerable cost. For telegraphy did something that Morse did not foresee when he prophesied that telegraphy would make one neighborhood of the whole country. It destroyed the prevailing definition of information, and in doing so gave a new meaning to public discourse. Among the few who understood this consequence was Henry David Thoreau, who remarked in Walden that we are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate. We are eager to tunnel under the Atlantic and bring the old world some weeks nearer to the new, but perchance the first news that will leak through into the broad, flapping American ear will be that Princess Adelaide has the whooping cough. Thoreau, as it turned out, was precisely correct. He grasped that the telegraph would create its own definition of discourse, that it would not only permit but insist upon a conversation between Maine and Texas, and that it would require the content of that conversation to be different from what typographic man was accustomed to. The telegraph made a three-pronged attack on typography's definition of discourse, introducing on a large scale irrelevance, impotence, and incoherence. These demons of discourse were aroused by the fact that telegraphy gave a form of legitimacy to the idea of context-free information, that is, to the idea that the value of information need not be tied to any function it might serve in social and political decision-making and action, but may attach merely to its novelty, interest, and curiosity. The telegraph made information into a commodity, a thing that could be bought and sold irrespective of its uses or meaning. But it did not do so alone. The potential of the telegraph to transform information into a commodity might never have been realized except for the partnership between the telegraph and the press. The penny newspaper, emerging slightly before telegraphy in the 1830s, had already begun the process of elevating irrelevance to the status of news. Such papers as Benjamin Day's New York Sun and James Bennett's New York Herald turned away from the tradition of news as reasoned, if biased, political opinion and urgent commercial information, and filled their pages with accounts of sensational events, mostly concerning crime and sex. While such human interest news played little role in shaping the decisions and actions of readers, it was at least local, about places and people within their experience, and it was not always tied to the moment. The human interest stories of the penny newspapers had a timeless quality. Their power to engage lay not so much in their currency as in their transcendence. Nor did all newspapers occupy themselves with such content. For the most part, the information they provided was not only local but largely functional, tied to the problems and decisions readers had to address in order to manage their personal and community affairs. The telegraph changed all that, and with astonishing speed. Within months of Morse's first public demonstration, the local and the timeless had lost their central position in newspapers, eclipsed by the dazzle of distance and speed. In fact, the first known use of the telegraph by a newspaper occurred one day after Morse gave his historic demonstration of telegraphy's workability. Using the same Washington to Baltimore line Morse had constructed, the Baltimore Patriot gave its readers information about action taken by the House of Representatives on the Oregon issue. The paper concluded its report by noting, "We are thus enabled to give our readers information from Washington up to 2 o'clock. This is indeed the annihilation of space." For a brief time, practical problems, mostly involving the scarcity of telegraph lines, preserved something of the old definition of news as functional information. But the foresighted among the nation's publishers were quick to see where the future lay and committed their full resources to the wiring of the continent. William Swain, the owner of the Philadelphia Public Ledger, not only invested heavily in the Magnetic Telegraph Company, the first commercial telegraph corporation, but became its president in 1850. It was not long until the fortunes of newspapers came to depend not on the quality or utility of the news they provided, but on how much, from what distances, and at what speed. James Bennett of the New York Herald boasted that in the first week of 1848, his paper contained 79,000 words of telegraphic content. Of what relevance to his readers, he didn't say. Only 4 years after Morse opened the nation's first telegraph line on May 24, 1844, the Associated Press was founded, and news from nowhere, addressed to no one in particular, began to crisscross the nation. Wars, crimes, crashes, fires, floods, much of it the social and political equivalent of Adelaide's whooping cough, became the content of what people called the news of the day. As Thoreau implied, telegraphy made relevance irrelevant. The abundant flow of information had very little or nothing to do with those to whom it was addressed, that is, with any social or intellectual context in which their lives were embedded. Coleridge's famous line about water everywhere without a drop to drink may serve as a metaphor of a decontextualized information environment. In a sea of information, there was very little of it to use. A man in Maine and a man in Texas could converse, but not about anything either of them knew or cared very much about. The telegraph may have made the country into one neighborhood, but it was a peculiar one, populated by strangers who knew nothing but the most superficial facts about each other. Since we live today in just such a neighborhood, now sometimes called a global village, you may get a sense of what is meant by context-free information by asking yourself the following question. How often does it occur that information provided you on morning radio or television or in the morning newspaper causes you to alter your plans for the day or to take some action you would not otherwise have taken or provides insight into some problem you are required to solve? For most of us, news of the weather will sometimes have such consequences. For investors, news of the stock market. Perhaps an occasional story about a crime will do it if by chance the crime occurred near where you live or involved someone you know. But most of our daily news is inert, consisting of information that gives us something to talk about but cannot lead to any meaningful action. This fact is the principal legacy of the telegraph. By generating an abundance of irrelevant information, it dramatically altered what may be called the information-action ratio. In both oral and typographic cultures, information derives its importance from the possibilities of action. Of course, in any communication environment, input, what one is informed about, always exceeds output, the possibilities of action based on information. But the situation created by telegraphy and then exacerbated by later technologies made the relationship between information and action both abstract and remote. For the first time in human history, people were faced with the problem of information glut, which means that simultaneously they were faced with the problem of a diminished social and political potency. You may get a sense of what this means by asking yourself another series of questions. What steps do you plan to take to reduce the conflict in the Middle East, or the rates of inflation, crime, and unemployment? What are your plans for preserving the environment or reducing the risk of nuclear war? What do you plan to do about NATO, OPEC, the CIA, affirmative action, and the monstrous treatment of the Baha'is in Iran? I shall take the liberty of answering for you. You plan to do nothing about them. You may, of course, cast a ballot for someone who claims to have some plans as well as the power to act, but this you can do only once every 2 or 4 years by giving 1 hour of your time, hardly a satisfying means of expressing the broad range of opinions you hold. Voting, we might even say, is the next to last refuge of the politically impotent. The last refuge is, of course, giving your opinion to a pollster who will get a version of it through a desiccated question and then will submerge it in a Niagara of similar opinions and convert them into, what else? Another piece of news. Thus, we have here a great loop of impotence. The news elicits from you a variety of opinions about which you can do nothing except to offer them as more news about which you can do nothing. Prior to the age of telegraphy, the information-action ratio was sufficiently close so that most people had a sense of being able to control some of the contingencies in their lives. What people knew about had action value. In the information world created by telegraphy, this sense of potency was lost precisely because the whole world became the context for news. Everything became everyone's business. For the first time, we were sent information which answered no question we had asked, and which, in any case, did not permit the right of reply. We might say, then, that the contribution of the telegraph to public discourse was to dignify irrelevance and amplify impotence. But this was not all. Telegraphy also made public discourse essentially incoherent. It brought into being a world of broken time and broken attention, to use Lewis Mumford's phrase. The principal strength of the telegraph was its capacity to move information, not collect it, explain it, or analyze it. In this respect, telegraphy was the exact opposite of typography.